Welcome to this episode of Anesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anesthetists. My name is Dr. Jennifer Prock, and I am an ST7 Anesthetic Registrar training at the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh in the South East Scotland School of Anesthesia. I am imminently preparing for my CCT, and I'm delighted to have Dr. Tara Byatt and Dr. Sarah Muldoon joining me today. We're going to be talking about the experience of transitioning to consultant level. I'd like to ask both Tara and Sarah to introduce themselves. Tara?
Hi, thanks, Jennifer. I'm Dr. Tara Byatt. I am a consultant at Royal Manchester Children's Hospital, which is a tertiary paediatrics hospital in the Northwest. I did all my training here in the Northwest, and I got my consultant job. I'd say it'll be coming up to 2 years this April.
Brilliant. Thank you. And Sarah?
Hiya, I'm Dr. Sarah Muldoon. I'm a consultant neuroanesthetist at King's College Hospital in South London. I went to med school in Glasgow and I was a foundation doctor there, but all of my anaesthetic training was done in South East London with a specialist unit at Queen's Square, the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery. I became a consultant in the middle of COVID back in 2020.
Brilliant. Thank you so much to both of you for being here today. And my first question to both of you is on how you view your role and what does the title of consultant mean to you?
I think it means it's the extra responsibility. When you're a resident and you're on a list with a consultant, ultimately you have an element of being a bit relaxed because you basically go along with what's going on. You might have an idea of what you want to do, but you don't necessarily put it into practice. Ultimately, if something goes wrong, the consultant's there. And I think the big difference for me is you now are the person that is ultimately responsible for the decisions and for the patient and for patient care, and also for a lot of managerial aspects of things as well. So I think it's a responsibility thing for myself. What would you say, Sarah?
Yeah, I've been nodding along as you said all of that, Tara. I hadn't actually put any real conscious thought into it before Jennifer asked the question either. But I think for me, it is the buck stops here kind of way of thinking about myself. And I do make a point in the mornings when I go to pre-assess my patients or when I meet them in clinic of saying, I'm Dr. Sarah Muldoon and I'm the consultant anaesthetist looking after you today. And at Team Brief, if I know everyone in the room, I'll just say, I'm Sarah, I'm the anaesthetist. But if there's somebody new who doesn't know me, again, I tend to make a point of saying, I'm the consultant anaesthetist. I don't know, I think it's a bit of acknowledging to the patient and to people who've not met you yet, like, if there's a problem, it's my problem and you have to come to me to take responsibility to solve it.
Yeah, I can't get down with that yet. I can't say the word consultant anaesthetist. I can't. Even when I'm on both here on the phone or anything and I'm like, oh, hi, I'm the anaesthetist from CPART. Hi, I'm Tara. I can't be like, I'm a consultant. It cringes me out.
Why?
Because I'm like, oh no. It's just, I just can't do it. I've said it a couple of times when probably I've needed to because maybe someone hadn't quite realised or because... You know, because I think when you're young and female, potentially people might think the resident who is the male might be the consultant or they're looking at someone. I might have had to say it. But generally, I'm like, no, I'm just going to say I'm the anaesthetist, actually.
I would add upon your experience of being a woman in theatre, because the number of times, particularly in my first few months, where a male surgeon would look to the male anaesthetic registrar and assume that was the consultant. But I also, not all patients, I don't think, fully get that an anaesthetist is a doctor. An anaesthetist can be a consultant. So for various medical, legal and gender political reasons, that's why I make this big habit of saying I'm a doctor, I'm the consultant. So I'm always confident that the patients have met me in the right role and have the right inference of how responsible I will be for their care today. And I would rather get in early with colleagues so that we don't have the awkward ambiguity later on as to who's actually been in charge for the past 8 hours.
No, you are right. I need to get over it.
Can we pick apart that idea a little bit more about our patients' expectations? Our patients are expecting more and more as their healthcare needs tend to increase. That's something that we need to manage to improve both their outcomes and their satisfaction. And so how can we better understand and address our patients' expectations as consultants?
I sometimes do get the feeling that some patients are particularly switched on to that idea of what, you know, this is a transactional relationship we're entering into today. I expect and deserve high quality care and they want to know how they're going to get that from you. To be honest, where I've most felt that responsibility and I've felt like I've had the most time and ability to convey that to patients is actually in the pre-assessment clinic. And actually, I find that meeting people while their date for surgery and perhaps a decision as to whether they're even going to have surgery is still up in the air, when you can meet them in a sort of information sharing, fact sharing kind of environment, explore their expectations, and you've got a 45-minute clinic slot in which to explain to them what an anaesthetic involves, what the risks and benefits of it are, what the implications of their own chronic health problems are, I think you get a much more real-world conversation with your patient, and they are able to gain a much more realistic expectation of what they can get from a sort of perioperative, periprocedural experience than you can if you've got 10-day surgery cases to quickly whip round in a unit in the morning. So actually, some of the most enjoyable and meaningful conversations I've had with patients are in the pre-assessment clinic as opposed to in the morning of a surgery itself.
Tara, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I totally get what you're saying. I don't do a pre-op clinic because there's only sort of a few anaesthetists that do it in our department. And there's others that might fill in, which I haven't yet had the opportunity to do. I think you're totally right. And I guess it's slightly different for me because it's like the parents that I'm interacting with of the child. And, you know, depending, you know, if it's a small baby, I'm just literally speaking to the parents. If it's a child that's a bit older that might be able to understand, there's obviously a bit of building up, a bit of a rapport with them as well. And I think that you're right. When you spend longer with them, it's better. And there's a better sort of understanding of how things are going to go. Sometimes your lists are so packed. Like we work on a few off-site hospitals, and there's one where we do a tonsils list. It's like 12 patients in a day. And so it's like super quick. I barely have any time to explain anything to them. And then they sort of all merge into one in your head. So I'm like, oh, this is a bit confusing at times. So I do think that you're right in spending more time with them makes the relationship better and the whole experience, I think, must be much better for both us as the clinicians and also the patients. And then for me, particularly the parents and the families as well.
Yeah, I do think you get that feel in the morning, though, don't you, of somebody who's got enough from you. If you try and end a conversation too soon, you can sense those people who've still got this sort of anxiety and this unasked question on their face. And I often find it one of the more enjoyable parts of the day. Like, I've got a medical student who wants to come tomorrow to pre-assess the patients on my list. People come so scared and so nervous, particularly the ones who've never had an anaesthetic or any real hospital experience before. And they're so uncertain and scared of the unknown. I really feel like it's the most satisfying part of the day sometimes when you leave someone after a 5-minute conversation about what you're going to do today and they look visibly relieved and less stressed about it. And given that that's really the only part of their interaction with us that a lot of our patients remember, if you see them in recovery afterwards and they say thank you or you've been great today, you know that literally the only thing they perceive you to have been great at is taking the time to talk to them and making them feel less anxious.
Yeah. I often feel my interactions are involving like one of the parents crying as they walk out. I'm trying to shove them out of the room really quickly because that's what happens. Like you talk to them at the start, you tell them what's going to go on, you put the kid to sleep. As soon as they're asleep, everyone's like give them a quick kiss, like out you go, thanks very much guys. And then they're like weeping as they leave the anaesthetic, and I most likely don't see them again. So it'd be like, that is, you know, my life.
Yeah, I definitely add so much when it's a child and you have this added responsibility to their parent. You're like, I'm going to take the most precious thing in your world away for a couple of hours. You've never met me before in your life, but you need to trust me to keep your child unconscious and breathing for you until I can return them to your care. And I've actually started preempting that awkward get out by saying, the minute your child falls asleep, the only thing I care about is them, and I'm going to be so abrupt with you and I'm going to get you out of the room really quickly just because I need to concentrate on your child.
You both spoke about assuming the responsibility of overseeing trainees as a consultant. Can you tell me about how I, as a senior trainee, can effectively prepare to assume that responsibility at consultant level?
I'm happy to talk about that first, if it's okay with Tara. I got quite a unique into my SC 7 year because of COVID, Jennifer. I had consultant colleagues who were shielding and couldn't come to work. We had gaps in our rota. So I was essentially asked to act up officially as a consultant on the rota for the last 3 months I was in training. And it segued really nicely. I managed to get a substantive job in that trust as well. So I got to act up and then stay on in official consultant capacity. And I would advocate, whether you can arrange it as a formal 3 months at the end of your training, or whether it's something you just make a real conscious effort to do in your last few months as an ST7, acting as if you are the consultant. I don't think you can have imposter syndrome if you and everyone else knows you are literally an imposter. So anything that you can do that looks like you're getting by as a consultant, you will give yourself a big giant tick for, and everyone else will too. And you feel like it's safe to fall at those hurdles as well, because you can be like, well, you know, I am just acting up. You guys need to support me. I'm doing my best. So I found it really beneficial. And I would say that you just need to finish your training in the mindset of, it's great that there's a consultant for the list today, but 6 months from now, it's me and it's my list. And you have to walk in and like dress your rehearsal mode and be like, if I was the one that had to take responsibility for any complications, any late finishes, any cancellations today, how would I want to conduct myself? And so being the person that arrives first, who already knew what was booked on the list, who'd already Googled the procedures and what the anaesthetic should look like, who checks on the patients in recovery or up in the wards before you go home, so that you get the sense of, I was the first person that patient met this morning. I was the last anaesthetist to say goodbye to them when they went home. I checked in on them either in person or on notes to see how they got on and when they were discharged. Did I give them enough analgesia? Were they sick? Like, just acting like the responsibility is yours, even though you know ultimately on paper it's still someone else's, I think is the best way of walking in the first day of your new job, which may even be in a new hospital, and feeling like you're ready for it for real.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think that you spend quite a lot of time during your training sort of doubled up with the consultant, don't you? And actually, if you get in ST7, well, I found that I was, you know, doing loads more solo lists. And actually, that's really the time when you can be like, oh, you know, do I even have a standard technique for this? Or do I even know what I would normally do? Am I always just doing what the consultant wanted me to do? So I think it's really an opportunity to try using some new things, or try stuff that you wanted to try before, but maybe didn't get the opportunity to, like, push yourself to do a few things at that point. And then I think that will sort of give you confidence when the responsibility is ultimately yours. What you said about the 3 month thing at the end, Sarah, that's a really great opportunity. And I don't know whether or not your rota permits this, but when I did the last bit of my, it was then called advanced year at the Children's, we had a bit of a backlog of residents coming through because of COVID. And so a couple of us did the acting up thing, but on the on-call rota. And that was really good because we did it during the day and at night. And again, you're right. You're just going in being like, I'm trying this out. I'm acting up. So that you can't really have imposter syndrome because everyone knows you're trying. And there was always still the consultant there to call if you needed them to come in. But it was quite nice. Even I even got the opportunity to be off-site on a night shift and then just see what it was like to be called. Like, you know, I was doing things like, where am I going to put my clothes? And maybe I don't really want to wake up my husband. So maybe I'll put my, and I was like trying to find a different room to put like my trainers and set out all my clothes if I suddenly had to get up in the middle of the night. And I was really obsessed that my phone wasn't on do not disturb. And I was like, well, how am I going to sleep? And am I going to just have a regular sleep? And it was really interesting just to have a little insight on what it might be like.
Yep, I absolutely would lay a whole outfit out. I would make sure that my house keys, car keys and glasses were all set out so I could grab them at the front door. And I, to this day, I'm obsessive about what point in the evening I'm on call. I take my makeup off. I do it as late as possible because I'm like, what if I wipe off this perfect eyeliner just for my reg to phone me in 5 minutes to say I have to go in to open another theatre?
That will be a disaster.
How has your practice changed in terms of being able to provide feedback to trainees when you're the ultimate responsible one for them, especially when you need to address sort of any areas for improvement or any negative feedback that you may have to give them?
I think that this has definitely been one of the most challenging things as transitioning to a consultant, because I'm in a big teaching hospital. So we always have residents the whole time and they rotate every 3 months. Some are there for longer. 3 months goes by in a second, and then there's a new cohort of people that you don't know. And during that 3 months, you might only work with someone once or never or a couple of times. So it's really quite tricky. And I had this whole thing where I was a bit like, can I even do this stuff? Because you spent the majority of your training doing adults, you get this proportion of time to do tertiary peds, and then suddenly you're the consultant. And then there's things, you know, neonates that don't come around really often, certain procedures like, you know, TOFs and CDHs that are quite rare, vascular access, lines, just loads of stuff that I wouldn't say, you know, you're doing routinely. And then I was like, if a resident's on a list with me, am I going to just be like, yeah, you have a go at that? Because if they can't do it, can I actually do it? And I think that's partly obviously a confidence thing, isn't it? It's improved. But right at the start, I was like, oh, I also don't want to be that consultant that's like, no, I must do that, please, because I hated them. So it's a weird thing where you sort of want to give them the opportunity and let them do what they want, but you kind of like toeing the line. I think it's quite challenging to work out how to be. And there's also a thing where, like, I sort of want to be liked. And so then, you know, I want to be like a person that people want to be on a list with. But then you've also got to sometimes be like, yeah, no, yeah, stop doing that, or that's unsafe, or don't do it like that. And you're kind of working out how to say it in a constructive way, which can be quite tricky, especially when you don't know people that well. Yeah, I think it's all that complex stuff going on the lists. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I agree with absolutely everything you said. And I didn't expect to feel those things at all. And I don't know if part of it is when you're a senior reg, you tend to be, certainly on all the rotas I worked, you tended to be paired with the same more junior anaesthetist at all times. So you almost had like an apprenticeship like relationship with each other, and you knew what each other was capable of. You would be on the same rota together for 3-6 months, if not longer. Whereas what changes when you're a consultant is, one, you end up with that. And I think I behaved like a very responsible senior reg when I was in training. But when you're a consultant, you've got what we talked about, that sense of anything bad that happens today is my fault. I have to take responsibility for it. You don't just have an anaesthetic to give. You've got all these other people to keep happy, the patients most importantly, but also the theatre staff hoping they're going to get an efficient day and get home on time, the surgeons hoping that you're going to efficiently help them get all the cases cleared. Management are going to come down and ask questions if you start or finish late. So you've got so many more people to be responsible for, so many more outcomes to be judged against. And you might not have met the resident anaesthetist that's with you ever before. You might know nothing about them. And you've no idea whether they've just finished an airway fellowship and they'll be better at the awake fibre optic that needs done than you will be, or whether this is the first case of this type they've ever done. It's so difficult to make a snap judgment first thing in the morning when you're trying to pre-assess all the patients, draw up your drugs, check your equipment, to be like, okay, now how also do we tailor our training into this? Is this somebody I can let do everything, or is this somebody who'll be happy if they can learn how to put in an art line? I find it so difficult. And I guess it's where forward planning comes in again. Having open forums within the department where you might not have worked with a trainee, but you get a sense from your colleagues as to how they're getting on. The resident doctors themselves having to think about, is this something I've ever seen done before? Could I read about it so I'm a bit more informed? What is it? Everyone to expectation manage themselves, essentially, to come to the list knowing a bit about the patients, a bit about the cases, and a bit about what you hope to get from the day. And I think that applies to everyone, whether you're a consultant, SES grade, resident or not. Just having a bit of a think about what can you put in and what can you take back out of the experience.
Yeah, I also feel like there's different residents, obviously, and there's some that have been there for a while and they're really experienced, some that aren't. And I feel like the best way is just to get on with your list and not have any expectations of the resident. And if they're really brilliant and really keen and can do loads of stuff, that's a bonus. And if they can't, it's fine. And you can sort of help them and support them and teach them. Also, just small things like remembering to say, do you want to go for a break? If, you know, that's quite tricky sometimes if you're like really concentrating on things or you've got a bit of a tricky case. Another thing with our hospital is we've gone fully electronics. We've got this system called Hive, which some residents have used at other hospitals within the trust, but you don't know where they've just rotated from. We've got a brand new ventilator that doesn't exist anywhere else in the Northwest. So they have to come to the children's hospital, do tertiary peds, which is, you know, freaks them out, plus learn a whole new ventilator, and a whole new system. I just think it's quite a lot for them, and especially the ones that have only just rotated in the first couple of weeks. And sometimes it's easy to forget when changeover is and you're expecting to do something. It's challenging knowing what people's levels are and then adapting your behaviour and teaching style to it whilst also concentrating on something that you might think is quite complex that you haven't done for ages.
I guess it ultimately comes down to everyone being considerate of what everyone else's cognitive load is. And I think you're more likely to feel available to teach and impart knowledge in a particular day if the person who's with you, and it doesn't matter who that is, it can be a medical student on elective, it can be an observing consultant from another trust, whoever is joining you in theatre, if you give something to each other, if you're also expecting to take something away from it. So I'm going to feel that I've got much more bandwidth available to teach if the resident is able to say to me, well, Dr. Modena, I actually got to work 5 minutes before you and I've already seen two of the three patients. Because then I'm like, great, well, that's less admin for me to do. So actually now we're already, we've got a head start in the day and I've got time to explain to you what this procedure is going to look like. And you've saved me 10 minutes. So if it takes you 10 minutes longer to do the procedure, then we're still in neutral time balance. So it's all these little things. Like none of us is just there to get something out of a day. We've all got to put something in. And so I think just helping each other out, everyone gets a bit more from the experience.
Definitely. I also feel like this is more earlier on, if I was really, really concentrating, it was a small baby and something I haven't done for a while, I'm sometimes like sort of silent. And yeah. So I'd say to them at the start, look, I'm not being rude. I just really need to concentrate on this. And I actually find this quite difficult. So I'm probably just not going to say anything during this whilst we do this. And then we'll talk about it later when we're in theatre and it's all settled down. I'm not, you know, I'm just sort of make sure they know I'm not trying to be.
Yeah, I think for quite a while I felt I had to mask all that. I need to seem like everything's under control and this is all coming straightforward and easy to me. And actually, I find it much better. And I think my mood probably comes across a lot better if I'm like, this is a really difficult day because this patient is risky because of X. So yeah. I'm going to concentrate. And if it's okay with you, I'd rather mess up this art line than you feel bad that you did. So I think sometimes if I'm just upfront about the things that are stressing me out that day, it makes other people a bit more aware of, oh, she's not teaching because she doesn't like me or she doesn't want to. It's because she's stuck in her own head until this part of the day is sorted.
It's been really interesting to hear your oversight about how you can give a bit of responsibility to a trainee, but you expect a bit in return and to make the actual theatre environment a nicer place for everyone to work. But do you have any advice on how to have those difficult conversations with trainees?
So you might have more to say on this than I do, because I haven't had to have particularly many conversations that can come to my mind where I've had to give difficult feedback to anyone yet.
I've also not had many situations where particularly negative things had to be said, I don't think. Mm. I think none of us want to hear criticism. None of us do. And it doesn't matter if you've been a consultant for 25 years. We have all got inherent personality traits that make us want to be perfectionists. And I think we all find it very difficult to hear if somebody doesn't think we have been perfect. And I think it feels extremely awkward to let somebody know if that's the case. I guess the overarching thing I bear in mind is it is a training programme, it is a residency. We wouldn't need a 7-year plus more in real life CCT programme if from day one of picking up a laryngoscope you were going to be a perfect anaesthetist. So we are all on a lifelong journey of getting better, and that has to include us being open to getting feedback. And if we're going to be effective educators, less uncomfortable with giving it. And I do a lot of sort of teaching and education out with the theatre environment as well. And I guess it's all about seeing mostly big picture stuff and then picking up on the small things. I find the supervision levels helpful in our supervised learning events. Like, because you can say to somebody, I'm sending this off as a 2A today. Probably if you were looking to do a similar case or similar list with another consultant, the things that would make me more likely to sign it off as a 2B or a 3 would be the following. So it's part of a constructive, this is what was good today and this is what would look even better a month from now. What do you think yourself, Jennifer, having got through 7 years of a training programme? How do you like to be told that something could be done differently or better?
I think the supervisory learning levels definitely help a lot in terms of having a structured way to give that feedback. But I think it's really important that that conversation happens before that's ever signed off on your portfolio. So you know, or you have the opportunity to ask questions about what you've done well or what you can improve on next time, exactly for that same example.
That has made me think there's lots of feedback, like multi-source feedbacks and MTRs and things. I wouldn't write anything down on one of those things that I wouldn't say face to face to the resident. I think that's sometimes what can be a little bit challenging, is you go through training or in that rotation thinking everything's fine, you're doing well, and then you get some negative feedback on that's anonymous, and it's unhelpful because it's out of place, it's out of context, you don't know when it happened, it's just one comment. I don't think that should ever happen. I think that if there was a problem, then the consultant or whoever is supervising you at that time should have said, actually, this is a situation, you know, you had a conversation with the person, rather than just sort of writing it anonymously. I sometimes think that's a little bit sneaky, let's say.
I think it's really hard to learn from that situation as a trainee, Tara, because I again don't have the context. I don't know who had that opinion or who had that feedback for me. And it's really difficult to then move on from that and to do better, to change your practice because of a comment that you have no context for.
And also, it's usually at the end of a placement, so you leave it feeling a little bit disheartened, which is unnecessary. And you're sort of racking your brains, aren't you? You're like, which list was this on? Who could have said this? When has this happened? And it's really unhelpful. So I don't think it's constructive.
We've talked a lot about the feeling and the want to be liked and to be a valued member of the team. Do you have any advice for managing surgeons' expectations?
So I think that this is obviously quite challenging. I guess it depends what your department's like. I think we have quite good relationships with our surgeons in our department, and we're able to have conversations. We're sometimes, not always, but sometimes email the list from the schedulers. We have a little bit of input on whether it's overbooked or timings of things, which is helpful. And I think if you end up working with someone regularly, you have build up a nice rapport with them, and you probably feel more comfortable to talk about things that might be a little bit tricky. Say, for example, we have to cancel this last case because it's running over. Nonetheless, I think it is still challenging. And when you're a newer consultant, I think you often feel like maybe you don't have the authority, or if you're working with a senior surgeon, I would sometimes say that maybe I don't feel I can stand up for myself in the way that maybe I would quite like to. I'm hoping that's going to change as I have more experience and I'm sort of in the department for longer. But I guess sometimes I still feel quite junior, or like maybe I'm still a resident. What am I even doing here? Imposter syndrome. It's definitely something that I can work on.
Again, I think it's something that we don't put a lot of thought or preparation into as we approach the end of training. I really love the surgeons that I work with. We've got quite a close-knit department in neurosurgery. So all the anaesthetists, all the surgeons, all the nursing staff, we all know each other. So that helps a lot to feel like you are part of a team and a unit. And I think we've got a lot of common ground. Most of us got on with each other personally and professionally. And I think that makes difficult conversations a lot easier to have. I guess it's good to start with a basic principle of assuming that for the most part, everyone has turned up to work to do good for patients. And that is usually most people's motivator. And I think if you start with that as your presumed common ground, you get a lot further. The surgeons that I work with give up so much of their own life's time, energy, headspace, because they want to do good work for patients. It would be fascinating to get a psychologist to personality profile all the different types of doctors. And there's definitely a massive amount of presenteeism and want to be at work and operating as much as possible among some of our surgical colleagues. I think as anaesthetists, we're like, yeah, we're happy here till five, but we've all got places to be at 5 past 5. But generally, everyone wants the best for the patients. But not everyone has always considered what another person's perception of what good for that patient looks like. And I think as anaesthetists, we do tend to be a bit more sensitive to what does for the good of the team look like. So a surgeon who operates once a week will willingly and with nothing but goodness in their heart sacrifice their own evening to stay late to get the list finished, not realising that every single one of their colleagues has thought the same thing Monday through to Friday and the staff are a bit fed up of being there late every day that week. So I definitely think we're better placed to sort of oversee the bigger picture and be like, there are some practical implications of what's happened today that we need to think about. And I remember the first time I cancelled a patient on a list, like this feeling of overwhelming responsibility. I'm letting down this patient. I'm letting down this surgeon. I'm letting an operating theatre go to waste. But I think if you can articulate what your concerns are, I think this woman has undiagnosed coronary artery disease and I'm scared she has a peri-op MI. If we go ahead today, it'd be nice to take 6 weeks to get this investigated and sorted out. When you are upfront about what your concerns are, what the implications for the patients are, it does tend to lead to a bit of a shared decision-making conversation where, well, the surgeon doesn't want the patient to have a peri-op MI either. And when you explain it to the patient, they don't either. If you can share what your concern is. There's been other times I felt I should cancel a case, but actually a patient has said, well, you might be worried about that doctor, but the reason it's so important to me for this to go ahead today, and they will give you this amazing and perfectly reasonable reason, they're willing to accept a bit of risk and you feel better about helping to manage that risk. I think just having open conversations with it and not trying not to let things get adversarial. It's not an us versus anyone situation. It's I want the best for the patients I'm here to look after today. I've got some concerns about achieving that. Here they are. Do you have anything to counter that I've not thought about yet?
Sarah, you mentioned there that we're best placed to advocate for the theatre team. How do you do that in your daily practice?
I guess I'm now worried that my theatre colleagues listen to this and critique my answer. Like I said, I do have the benefit of working in a sort of close-knit community in the neuro theatres at King's. I think getting to know each other, first of all, makes a big difference. And we do spend a fair amount of time socialising. If anyone was walking through Ruskin Park a couple of weeks ago, they'd have seen us all playing relay races and picnicking together. The common situation where this comes up is when the team start to get worried that a list is going to overrun.
Yeah.
And you can generally feel that concern and anxiety start to percolate around the theatre. And usually someone in the team will either come to you themselves or go and have a word with one of their own managers, and somebody will come up and start whispering in your ear, do you think we're going to overrun today? Do you think we'll have time to do the third case? We're not going to add anything onto this list, are we? And I guess you just have to find out a bit about what the concern is. Has it been a short-staffed week with lots of sickness and everyone's exhausted?
To what I think, interestingly, my consultant interview presentation was about morale of theatre staff. And so I went to the department and asked a few of them, you know, sort of what they thought, how we could improve morale, that kind of thing. And one of the top things was, you know, stop making us finish late. And I think I think when you come to work in the morning and you see your list, you are already thinking, can I get this done? How can I make this as efficient as possible? Can we get through all these patients and will we finish on time? You can't help it. That's, you know, it's human nature. And I think that's what the residents are thinking. You know, when you go to the residents, what do you want to get out of the day? I used to want to be like, I just want to have a nice day and go home on time. Am I allowed to say that? And I think that's just what is the general consensus is. I think that's what everyone's working towards. As you said about the surgeons, they might only be operating once a week or once every other week. But for those theatre staff that are there nearly every day, it's late finishes for them all the time. And I think that they, especially where we are, because it's children, there's a bit of emotional manipulation that goes on going, oh, but it's a child. And I'm like, yeah, but it's always a child because it's a children's hospital. And I don't think that that's a reasonable thing to say. I do my best as an anaesthetist to try and make it run smoothly, to make sure that I'm prepared for each case so the downtime between cases is as small as possible. I will make sure with a coordinator, if it needs to be a run through, there's people that have, if there's enough people to relieve people, otherwise we'll stop for lunch. And I'm definitely deliberate about that. And then I guess when it's coming towards the end, if I think we have to cancel a case, then I will speak to the coordinator who's like excellent, and who will sometimes come in and just tell the surgeon so I don't even have to. I will make sure that the theatre team know that we're not staying. I think it's difficult because they will feel like it's the anaesthetist and the surgeon. And if they say they can stay, then they are forced into it. And even when someone goes to them, can you stay? I think that direct question in front of everyone isn't helpful because they don't often feel empowered enough to say, actually, no, I want to go home. And I don't think that anyone should have a reason for why they want to go home. If you want to go home and start watching your TV, fine, or you've got loads of plans. I don't think people should have to have a reason for why they want to finish work on time. It's okay to want to finish work on time. And I think as the anaesthetist, it's important to be like, yeah, sorry, the patient needs to be in recovery by this time. It looks like you've said this is going to be X amount of time. We're not going to be able to do it. What do you think? It doesn't really sort of make sense. And I think there's ways of saying it, aren't there? Rather than we just need to cancel this patient. I think being like, oh, you've said this is going to be an hour with the anaesthetic time is probably going to take us to about this time. So we'll be running late. What do you think about that? And have the discussion and then get the coordinator involved. I think that's probably how I would advocate for the team on a day-to-day basis for the theatre team.
Yeah, and I think that's actually the issue. There's stuff you can do day-to-day, and then there's the things that you need to do behind the scenes for sort of longer-term management of issues like that. So on the day, there's a balance between asking the team to stay late yet again and the horrible situation you put a patient in of having them starved all day long, prepped for weeks for an operation, arranged childcare, time off work, to tell them we've run out of time and cancelled it. So you're constantly making those micro decisions, like what is the least worst thing to do for the fewest amount of people today. So you can be as efficient as possible yourself. When you've spotted that a list looks busy or a case looks complex, try to encourage everyone to do the small things we can do to reduce the downtime between lists. And I think you almost have to like bank goodwill. So the staff have to know that you won't overwork them unnecessarily, because every now and again, there'll be a case so complex or so difficult to have booked or such an unexpected complication or delay that you're like, I'm sorry, but we are all going to have to stay late tonight to get this done. But it is so unfortunate that there's this lingering hierarchy that it's fine for me or Tara and our surgeons to say, nah, we've got plans tonight and so we're definitely finishing in time. But one of our colleagues isn't empowered to be like, well, my childcare is done at 6, so I've got to be out of here too. And so often you will be the one that gets these whispered, I really have to get out of here today, Sarah. And you have to pretend it's an anaesthetic decision that the list can't continue to get your other colleagues out of work on time. So sometimes it's more a case of you have to let a list running late slide. You have to deal with the surgeon and patient being disappointed that a case is cancelled to sort of collect a bit of evidence and data that this seems to be a perpetual problem on this day of the week or this particular list or when we have this particular procedure, so that you can speak to the managers and say, do you know what, we can't list two of these on the same day because it doesn't get done. We shouldn't do this on a Friday because we've always got teaching and that steals some time from the list. So there's stuff that you can do on the day, but sometimes it's just about keeping an eye on patterns and individuals and issues that creep up over and over again and speaking to your colleagues collaboratively to try and nip them in the bud or smooth them over.
I've just completed my last ARCP.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Do you have any advice for me on how I can approach my first appraisal as a consultant?
Tara, how many appraisals have you done so far?
One, and my second one's coming up in October. So it's usually your birth month, isn't it? Or around your birthday. What I think is really different is, so in the Northwest, we've got like a really great website that the TPD, et cetera, have written. And it's really great where it tells you each training grade, exactly what the minimum requirements are, what number of SLEs, you know, CPD summary, all the documents that you need to include. And it's really, really prescriptive. And I've just always used that. And then I think I found that suddenly I had my first appraisal and I have it with, it was the CD at the time. So another anaesthetist in the department. And I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing. So I knew I had to log on to this system. And there are things that you need to make green, but there wasn't really any guidance of how much I was supposed to write in each box. And I also think it's very variable in terms of who your appraiser is. So in the ARCP, your panel's pretty standardized, and then whoever's on that day sees the same sort of two or three panels, how it works, presumably same with you, Jennifer. It's pretty fair, I'd say. Whereas I think when you're a consultant, you probably could have an appraiser that's quite lenient and not so bothered about how much you filled in and just sort of sign you off. And there's so obviously ones that are going to be a little bit more by the book. So I think it's probably a very different experience depending on who you get. I actually spoke to one of my colleagues who had been a consultant in the department for a couple of years, and he showed me his portfolio and I had a quick read through. So I had some idea of what I was supposed to be writing and how many things I needed to write. And then I kind of use that as a guide. So that was very helpful. So I'd probably recommend just speaking to another colleague that's gone through the process before you do your first appraisal. But ultimately, I think it's not maybe something to be as worried about as you might think it is in your head.
So I really missed the structure and the micromanaging of being in the training programme when it went from ARCPs to what are essentially self-directed appraisals. And I am like a child having a tantrum, being dragged kicking and screaming to our appraisal platform to get mine done. Whereas when you're in the academic year and you know it needs to be done by this date because your ARCP is on that date and your educational supervisor and your college tutor and your TPD are all going to be on your case if it's not done, doing your appraisal is much more an autonomous process where you cannot do it and nothing bad will happen immediately, but eventually your clinical director, your trust responsible officer and the GMC are going to be very angry with you. And I found similarly, a more experienced colleague showed me what his portfolio looked like so that I could attempt to replicate the same things. And I guess the one thing that I perhaps find a bit easier about it is that you can actually set yourself objectives for the coming year, or you might set an objective that you're like, that's not achievable within 1 year. I can do this over 2 or 3 years, that actually do match what you're doing. So you can be like, well, this is my first year as a consultant. I've got a regular list doing X. One of my objectives for next year is going to be to have developed a sort of expert level knowledge base in this surgery or this anaesthetic technique. So you can be a lot more sort of focused and envision what you want to be able to say you can do in 1 to 2 years and write an objective in that way. What I've recently been taught to do by a colleague is to create a folder in my email inbox called appraisal. And every time something appraisal worthy drops into it, like an attendance certificate for a conference or a bit of positive feedback, you drag and drop it into your appraisal folder. And then when you're thinking, I've absolutely no idea what I can put in this appraisal, you've already got a folder of evidence sitting there waiting for you.
Have you done that?
I have, yeah.
And well, that's very good, because I feel like I have wanted to do that throughout the whole of training and I just never did. And I was always right at the end searching through my inbox and, you know, looking for stuff to upload. But obviously that is a great idea.
Yeah. My other bit of advice of something that I wish I did but don't actually do is trying to make a point once a month of going through your work calendar and populating the work things you've done into the lifelong learning platform or into whatever your trust appraisal platform is, because I will imminently have to sit down with 12 months worth of my work calendar to populate that, and this will be the 5th year running, and boy do I wish that I would learn to do that on a 4-weekly basis instead of doing it 12 months at a time.
Sarah, you talked a little bit about setting some personal goals, and I know that kind of with any change there's going to be an adjustment period. So when will I know it's the right time to take on other opportunities as a consultant?
I think everyone is different. And I remember being given advice myself, say no to absolutely everything for your first year. There are some people who are incapable of saying no or would be really, really bored if they didn't do any stuff. And I guess the thing to ask yourself is, how comfortable are you with what's on your plate at the moment? And therefore, how much capacity to add a little side plate do you have? So maybe if you're staying in a trust as a consultant that you already know really well as a trainee, then actually you already know people, places, the computer software, the anaesthetic machines. You probably do have more bandwidth to say, fine, I can be a lead for that, or I can do a massive quality improvement project. Whereas if you're moving across the UK to a new country, to a new trust, you probably do need to protect psychological safety time just for getting to know the ins and outs of the hospital before you start trying to do something new and exciting. And similarly, I guess if you find yourself with a really busy clinical job with stuff that you hadn't done a huge amount as a trainee, you'll need a bit of time to just actually direct your non-clinical time to reading, preparing, thinking about that. Whereas if you've done a 12-month fellowship in something like PEDS, like Tara, and you're working in a PEDS hospital, then actually, again, you've probably got some spare mental capacity to think about different things and different projects. But it is absolutely fine to just enjoy having a consultant job plan that means that you can go for coffee with your friends and your days off, or plan holidays, or say yes to weddings without having to put a huge amount of thought and rota chess into whether you can attend them or not.
That's very much where I am at the moment. Like, I've not taken on any extra roles apart from I became an ES sort of 6 months in. I achieved ES status when I was a resident. So then I thought, well, I may as well just get on with submitting all that paperwork and then becoming one. But other than that, I haven't taken on any roles as of yet. I feel like this, you sort of feel that there's a pressure because you, as a resident, and you're constantly working towards your consultant job, there's a lot of pressure, I think, to do loads of projects and audits or quality improvement things, and you feel like you're really judged and people are looking at, you know, whether you're a really good trainee or not. And actually, when you're a consultant, no one's really expecting anything of you, really. If you want to go to work and just, and you know, and do your best during the day and then go home on time, yeah, feel free to do that. I don't think you have to take on any roles ever if you don't want to, but you know, you might get bored. And I think you've got to remember that if you've chosen, and I expect to hopefully retire in the department that I'm in, that I've got many years to take on roles in the future, and I don't think there's a rush. So just sort of see how you feel, really.
I think it's going to be really lost on the recording that Tara did air quotes around the phrase on time, and people will think she was being serious about that.
Yes.
You've both answered all of my questions, but I'd like to give you the opportunity, if you have any other reflections on your own personal experience or what we can do to support ourselves through this transition period.
I feel like I'm probably still transitioning. And I wonder how long it will take for me to feel like I'm not anymore. I think the whole process was much smoother than I thought it was going to be. And I really love the department. I would say to, you know, you, Jennifer, and other people that are coming up to CCT, when you choose the department that you want to work in, unless you are very fixated on a specific subspecialty, I think choosing the department because of the people that are there and the culture of it is the most important thing to do. And I think it will probably mean that you are happier at work. I also was going to say that, you know, I hope that this conversation that we've had has showed people that everyone feels the same. And we all sort of, you know, we're all going to get anxious. Changing, transitioning to being a consultant is a scary time, and no one's probably going to feel ready. And there's going to be challenges, and it'll take people different times to adjust. But ultimately, you know, you will all be fine. You will be excellent.
I've been a consultant for 5 years now, so I'm definitely not the newest in the department anymore. But obviously, I've got lots of even more experienced senior consultant colleagues above me to look up to as well. I think one of the useful things I learned when I CCT'd was that bit of paper does not mean you are done. You've not completed anaesthetics. You don't know the answer to every difficult patient and every anaesthetic nuance for every possible case. It's just a way of saying you have trained and learned enough that you can now use your survival skills to get through most problems. And actually, everyone helps each other out. And to this day, I'm on about, what, 4 or 5 different colleague WhatsApp groups where we all check each other's homework. Like, what would you do for this case? This patient's got this comorbidity. Would you do it? Postpone it? What would you organise? People continue to help each other out. I wouldn't get through a day at work without the advice of not just anaesthetic colleagues, but nursing colleagues, surgical colleagues, the admin teams on the ward who help to make life make sense. So you're not done and you're not independent, because you essentially, if you pick the right department, you are a family that gets each other through the day. And I can honestly say that I love my job and everything I've gone through to get here was absolutely worth it. When my alarm goes off at 6 a.m. on a working day, I am pleased to be getting up and going in to do something that I love doing and I think I'm good at and I think makes a positive difference to the people I get to interact with, whether they're colleagues or patients. So I would say to you, Jennifer, it has been worth it and I hope you really enjoy whatever you end up doing next.
Thank you so much, Tara and Sarah.
Thank you, Jennifer. It was a pleasure to be here.
It was a pleasure, Jennifer. Good luck with what you do next.
And thanks to you for listening. From exploring approaches to appraisals and feedback, to navigating the dynamics of teamwork and communication with both surgeons and patients, our discussion today has highlighted the transition to consultant. And I'd like to thank both Tara and Sarah for their insightful reflections and for providing assurances in the professional growth that accompanies this transition. We'll have more information and useful links in the episode description. And for more podcasts like this, make sure you subscribe to Anesthesia on Air and review us while you're there.